The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, listeners, and welcome to the Tuesday Space Show. I am David Livingston. It's great to be here. Thank you all for tuning us in. And let's do the announcements, and I want to bounce something off of all of you for feedback, and hopefully you will give me feedback. But first, those of you who would like to call the program tonight and talk with our guest or myself, that toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. And then email, of course, is always the same, dmlivings@yahoo.com, drspace@thespaceshow.com, or you can use thespaceshow@gmail.com. And for chat, we're using the AOL program, so we have IM, ICQ, and CompuServe. And the screen name is the same for all of them, one word, Space Show Chat. Please remember we're trademarked and copyrighted and registered, but you can copy the shows, download them, send them around on the big file sending program, a memory stick, whatever you want to do to get the word out as to why space is important. But please, nothing commercial with any of the programs and no changes in the text or dialogue of any of the interviews. And we do thank Andrew and Gigadial. They give us our podcasting service. You'll find the RSS URL to subscribe on our website and both of our newsletters. If you have a problem with our podcast, please let us know, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And our website is thespaceshow.com. And if you go there, you'll see that we have a newsletter on the front page of the website. You'll see a big button for it. And it is uploaded every Monday, California time in the morning. It has all of the details of the week's programming. It has future events. And then if we have to make modifications in programming during any given week or we have to make an announcement of something going on, this is where you'll see it first. You can also find instructions for subscribing to our very short email newsletter, which also goes out Monday, California time. And it's just one or two lines about the programs for the week, designed not to clutter up your inbox. And so if you want to subscribe to that, send a note to Dr. Space at thespaceshow.com. Everything we do is archived, and all of our programs from 2001 are up there, free of charge, no registration, no login. You can listen to them from our website, or you can easily download the programs. And as I say all the time, go back and listen to some of the older shows, especially ones where the guest has been on several times, and check out the evolutionary nature of space or what the guest is talking about. We have a store on our website. Perhaps you'll find some items of interest for the holidays. I hope so. And then you'll see the Support the Space Show button. Remember, we're a 501c3 with the One Giant Leap Foundation. We do need your support. We appreciate very much those of you who do support us and have supported us, and those of you who will support us in the future. It is a huge undertaking for me to do this show. I do it alone, and I can't do it without your help. So thank you very much for doing that. I'm going to skip hold the dates because I want to make another announcement. But do remember we're in Twitter, MySpace, and Facebook. And also remember that the Space Show is now brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation, which promotes cooperative solutions for space security. And for more information, visit SecureWorldFoundation.org and listen to the shows that they have been on. They've been on a few shows, and they're coming on again later in January. Good programming with this group. Here's what I want to bounce off of you, because I get requests to do shows, and I'm going to say by out-of-the-box individuals or organizations. And it's hard to put as many as I get on the show. Many of them would end up being an infomercial, And many of them, you might wonder, why in the heck are you putting this on? It's too crazy. But maybe it's not crazy. I'm not a judge of what's crazy or not. Anyway, I'm thinking of dedicating 2 weeks in either February or March and 2 weeks in either October or November to out-of-the-box week on the space show. And all of these programs or people or books or whatever that request these types of programs that fit into this category, they come on the program during one of these two-week periods, and that's it. They can't come on during the regular space show, you know, time periods. And they're all lumped together, and that would give 16 of these shows per year. So, and if they don't want to be in the out-of-the-box week, then they don't come on the show. End of story. So I'd like your feedback on that. Do you think that's a good idea? Do you think the space show should do that? Do you think I should even consider putting some pretty far out-of-the-box programs on the show, or people that would end up using the program as an infomercial? And by the way, I do not get paid to put anybody on the show, and I will never take money from anybody or anyone to put them on the show. So they may use the program like an infomercial, but trust me, I'm not getting anything out of it. And if I decide to put them on, I want to do it in one of these 2 weeks periods. So send me an email. Let me know if you think that that would be an okay idea, or what you think of it. Okay, on to our program tonight. We are really honored to have with us Jeffrey Manber, and he is, well, you know, the whole space tourism Russian thing really started with Jeffrey, but he's a recognized innovator in bringing about a competitive space marketplace, and in the 80s, he worked with Shearson Lehman to realize the first Wall Street fund dedicated to private space ventures. I bet he's glad he's not with them now, or wasn't with them, you know, earlier this year. In the 90s, he served as managing director of Energia USA, representing the Russian space organization NPO and Energia, I guess that's how I should be pronouncing it, in its discussions with NASA and American Aerospace Company. And he also assisted in the privatization of NPO Energia. Later, he became the CEO of Mir Corp, which was the Dutch venture that leased the Russian space station Mir. Signed with NBC to do a game show in space, signed Dennis Tito to his historic launch contract, and he worked with Hollywood stars from James Cameron to Mark Burnett of Survivor and Lance Bass of NSYNC. Currently, he is CEO of SFE Spaceworks, a new venture co-founded by Professor Bob Twiggs of Stanford University, among others, to provide a platform for the small launch vehicle SmallSat community. And it is scheduled to open in the new year. He also advises organizations and companies on space policy and trade issues. His full bio will be up on the website when we archive this program. Jeffrey, welcome to the Space Show. Long overdue. How are you?
I was going to say the exact same thing, David. Long overdue. Great to be here tonight.
Start us out, and, you know, Mir Corp has always been fascinating. I went to a Space Frontier Foundation venture capital thing at the Doubleday Hotel years ago, a luncheon and afternoon session for venture capitalists, and somebody was there from Mir Corp and wanted to raise money and had a prospectus that he would give, and I forget his name, you know, for qualified investors, and this was just at the start of Mir Corp, and he made a presentation at that luncheon meeting for Mir Corp. It's always fascinated me, so start at the beginning and tell us about it.
Well, you know, Mir Corp was a fascinating venture. It was a fascinating period in my life, and I'm extremely proud of Mir Corp. I mean, because a lot of the things that we see taking place in the new space community today have their direct origins with Mir Corp. And probably one of the most important things that came out of Mir Corp was we proved the business model that, you know what, people outside the traditional aerospace marketplace, people outside of traditional government contracting, were interested in using space for entertainment purposes, for media purposes. And before that, it was just one of those things that would hang in the Washington air. People would say, you know, wealthy people want to go to space. Well, do they? How do you prove that? And there was study after study. The United States government must have spent $500,000 trying to quantify whether there was a market for space tourism. And we proved there was a market for space tourism. We proved that done correctly, Hollywood would be interested in using space. We proved that television stations and producers like Mark Burnett would be interested in using space. And I think from out of that came the Elon Musks and the Bigelow Aerospace, who saw that, you know what, there is another way to do it. Maybe use of a space station owned by the Russian organization NPO Energia that went against the wishes of NASA is not the best business model to invest your money. But we did prove that there is a market for what is today considered new space markets, and of that I'm really proud. I'll tell you that we signed the lease to take over the Mir in London in I think it was February of 1999, and Yuri Semyonov, the general designer of Energia, was there, and there were probably about 50 reporters from around the world in the room, and they were all very serious. It was a very serious occasion. And when I got to the part of our business model, not all of it, but part of the business model would be that we wanted to sell tickets to what Rick Tumlinson called citizen explorers, the reporters burst out laughing. And I've never forgotten that. I mean, they just couldn't accept the idea that wealthy people would spend millions to go to space. And I think that was a fundamental breakthrough that we accomplished with Mir Corp.
I totally agree with you. What was the the word is, and most people think that NASA really intervened and that caused, you know, Mir to be deorbited and didn't want competing space stations with the ISS. Was NASA the problem there? Could Mir Corp have raised the money? Could it have been successful?
We had three major impediments that we were confronting. The first, believe it or not, was the intense solar flare activity of the sun that year. I mean, we were probably one of the few ventures or the only private sector venture ever done in by a period of intense solar flare activity. And the reason that was an impediment was that the solar flares were an increased drag on the Mir space station. And it was coming down much quicker, and we had to send up an extra progress vehicle, which cost us an extra $10 or $15 million. So impediment number one was the solar flares. Impediment number two was the dot-com crash in March of 2000, just when the two original investors of Mir Corp, Walt Anderson and Kiran G. Patheria, were going out into the New York and London markets and Hong Kong and going to their colleagues. The situation was much like it is today, where people who a few months before $5 million or $10 million was fund money, and they could, sure, they'll throw it on this exciting venture that's privatizing the Mir space station or marketing it commercially. But in after March, those people disappeared, as well as did the liquidity of our two original investors. So those two factors were huge. A third factor was the intense emotional reaction of the NASA administrator, Dan Golden. Dan Golden never understood the business model of Mir Corp. And the day after we signed the lease in London, Golden was testifying at an extraordinary hearing, it's called, in Washington, and he was livid. And what upset him was that NASA was paying $65 million for a Soyuz. And according to published reports, we had gotten a Soyuz for $25 million. And over and over, I would explain to NASA officials, White House, reporters, that Mr. Golden needed to understand capitalism, that Energia was a partner was a shareholder in Mir Corp. And that if we succeeded, if we, Mir Corp, succeeded, Energia, which owns 60% of Mir Corp, the value of its shares of stock, because it too was and is a private company, would be worth more. Plus, Energia was our contractor. So let's say in the case of a Dennis Tito, if Dennis Tito flew to the Mir, Energia would gain because Mir Corp's stock would go up. Its stock would go up, and it would be paid and would walk away with 80-90% of the Tito money. And so the fundamental problem, I wouldn't say NASA was a problem. I would say the fundamental problem was right at the top, and that Dan Golden took it. And to one reporter, New York Times reporter, he said, "I'm in the phone book. They should have called me." And I think he did take it very personally, and it hurt us very much. We did have several investors interested in investing and coming in despite everything, and then they would just see the negative comments coming out of NASA and hence the Russian Space Agency. And you have to remember, we were fighting not only NASA, we were also fighting the Russian Space Agency. And so it was an extremely difficult time. We came very close. But I would have to say there's no disputing that Dan Golden took it emotionally, was very upset by Mir Corp. He felt that it was somehow a trick on the part of Energia, when in fact it was one more effort by Yuri Semyonov and by Energia to fund their production line. There was no money coming from NASA. There was no money coming from the Russian government. And with the money that we brought in, it was funding the production line, which helped not only Mir Corp, not only the Mir, but also the International Space Station. And somehow, Dan Golden could never seemingly get himself around the fact that without the Russian government being able to provide funding, Energia, even as a commercial company, took it upon itself to take money earned from Sea Launch, a multi-billion-dollar project that launches satellites from the Pacific Ocean, from a mobile platform, Pacific Ocean. They would take profits from Sea Launch and divert it to the production line, which was helping the International Space Station. And it would be as if Boeing had a good year with the planes, with the 777s, and they took the profit and used it to prop up NASA because their budget's going to be cut in the next administration. That was the situation we found ourselves, and Dan Golden just never seemed to be able to accept that scenario.
You've got an email question from Jerry in Joplin, and he says, why didn't you guys go and talk to Dan Golden and try to explain the situation to them so that he would be diffused? And how were you able to take your contracts to Mir and transfer them to the ISS?
Great question. Two great questions. I worked for Energia through much of the 90s, and I helped privatize Energia and represented them in Washington. And so I knew Dan Golden quite well, and he knew me. And Dan Golden was always bothered by the presence of a privatized Energia. And I think he would be the first to say that he was very much troubled by the idea that a commercial company could be that strong. And he was always looking to prop up the Russian Space Agency and reduce the influence of Energia. And at the same time, as I said, he didn't quite seem to understand that Russia was not supplying any funds, despite the international agreements they were signing. So my answer is, first off, I knew Dan well, and knew that he would go livid over Mir Corp. And when we approached Yuri Kopteyev, the head of the Russian Space Agency, over our Christmas, you know, the Russians have Christmas
in January, right.
Kopteyev was in disbelief and just shook his head as to what he'd have to, you know, he knew how Dan Golden would be. So my first answer is, I understood him. He's a temperamental guy, emotional guy, and I knew he disliked Energia, disliked the commercial path that Energia took, and I knew his reaction, what his reaction would be to Mir Corp. My second answer is that at the time, Rick Tumlinson, who I know is a regular on your show.
Right, a good friend.
Rick introduced me to Walt Anderson, and that's how I got involved with MirCorp. And Rick went off, and instead of being involved in the operations of MirCorp, he was involved in the fascinating project called, it was a Tether project, I think, called Firefly. And the original idea of MirCorp was not that we would race around the world and in 6 to 8 months need to raise another $50-60 million, or the Mir would fall from the sky. The original idea was beautiful. It was, let's use this Tether, see if we can boost the orbit of the Mir into a parking orbit, and then take a year to come up with some means to save the station. The problem was the State Department, with Dan Golden's strong support, blocked the export of the Tether. And we were forced not into a more normal pattern, but one of racing. And the reason I raise that is Rick, the lawyers that Rick was using at the time, a Washington law firm, had a meeting scheduled about 2 days after the lease was signed, a meeting with Dan Golden to brief him on the Tether, to brief him on MirCorp, and we all felt, you know, better than coming from me or coming from Rick, it would come from this respected law firm in Washington, and they would explain what we're doing, what we're not. He canceled the meeting, and he never rescheduled. In fact, I found it funny because the law firm for almost 6 weeks kept trying to reschedule to get on the administrator's calendar. And finally I said to him, guys, he ain't going to see you. And so that's my long answer, is that Dan knew exactly, you know, what he liked and what he didn't like, and he didn't like a privatized Russian space program. Regarding the second question, Energia worked with MirCorp on every contract. And Energia, and my old friend at Energia, Alexander Durechin, would be in charge of making sure that the contracts were as bulletproof as possible. And every contract had a clause in it. Every contract we signed with NBC, and we were working with James Cameron and with Dennis Tito, every contract said, in the event for some reason that we could not implement this contract and provide a service to the Mir, it will be transferred to International Space Station. And every major contract we signed at MirCorp, despite Yuri Kopteyev's dislike of MirCorp as well, the head of the Russian Space Agency, his signature was on our contract as well. So, for example, the Dennis Tito, the historic first launch contract with Dennis Tito, was signed by myself from MirCorp, Semyonov from Energia, and Kopteya from the Russian Space Agency. And it had a clause in it, I was 11-something, I happen to remember, that said, in the event that it could not be implemented on Mir, we will do best efforts to transfer it over to ISS. So that's how it happened. And certainly, even though Kopteya and Semyonov were often at odds themselves, Kopteyev understood better than anyone that he didn't have the funds for the Soyuz production line. And in that sense, he reluctantly supported Semyonov's efforts because they kept the production line going.
You know, many of us will remember how absolutely drama queen and hysterical NASA was about not allowing Tito on the space station. And of course, they finally relented. I think it was almost like an 11th hour relenting. No one knew that he could go until toward the very moment of launch. How do you attribute that hysteria?
I believe, I've had a long time to think about it. I'm writing a book on my time with the Russian space program that will be out in the fall. And if you're kind enough, I'd love to come back in a few months and when I'm ready to talk about the book.
Absolutely.
But I've been thinking a lot about it lately. And I think that the recurring theme in my working with Energia was the strong emotional dislike of Dan Golden to a privatized a nerve yet. And you'll have, I mean, I think that, giving it a lot of thought lately, I think that Dan Golden is a bit of a romantic. And I think that he believed passionately that NASA working with the Russian Space Agency was the symbol of a new era in Russian-American relations. Whereas I worked with Energia to try and change the business model that had existed since Kennedy, that space is a political symbol and an instrument of politicians. And the Kennedy model of space exploration was that you would have a big centralized government agency and international cooperation is done for political purposes. Whereas Semyonov and others, Walt Anderson and everyone today in the new space community, space was an extension of the marketplace of Earth. And if Energia was successful, it would downplay the symbolism of the two governments. We desperately, fervently wished to reduce not only the role of the government on the Russian side, but of course the role of the government appropriately on the American side. And so I think that's the reason why Dan Golden reacted the way he did, because he was a romantic about the end of the Cold War. And he spoke, as you, I'm sure you recall, and a lot of your listeners remember, he spoke very eloquently about symbolism of NASA and the Russian Space Agency working together. For me, it was yesterday's news. For me, it was, here's a chance to bring about a true commercial business model to show that the private sector could run Mir station operations. One of the proudest accomplishments with Mir Corp that I had was the scientific programs we conducted on the Mir during our 70-day mission. And we did real science, and we were a private company working appropriately with the government, and that is what angered me so much about Dan Golden's emotionalism. Regarding, you know, the Tito battle, it was an extraordinary mistake on the part of Dan Golden, a wonderful mistake, because for years, Energia, and in a small way myself, we had tried to take on NASA. But it was a battle that the American public never really got hold of. They understood a little bit. You had Deke Slayton flying the Conestoga, and that made the headlines. But the public, the American public, never really understood why Americans would be battling NASA on space. I mean, NASA is space. End of story. And every time a commercial venture sort of popped up above the radar screen, it was briefly, and it would go away. And NASA would triumph in the public's imagination.
You got it.
Golden made a fateful mistake. He took on an American businessman, a Republican, wealthy American businessman, who wanted to go to space for no commercial reason. If he could have flown on the shuttle, Dennis Tito would have been a happy camper. He saved his money. He earned it on Wall Street, and he spent it to have the ride of his life. It's the American dream. And Dan Golden fought him and fought us. And that struggle, ironically, really captured the attention of the media and the public. And they just sort of, I mean, I would talk to people and they just sort of shake their heads and say, why is NASA against this? And I'm really thankful in an odd way that Golden launched his attack on us. I mean, it was emotional. Barbara Mikulski on the floor of the Senate called those working to support Dennis Tito pimps.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, I mean, and what were we doing? We were selling a ticket. And we were helping someone realize their dream. And there were media outlets. I mean, the New York Times was incredibly against it. They called it a rich man's eco-tourist nightmare, and I wrote them saying that, you know, hopefully this editorial of yours will rank along with your condemnation and ridicule of Goddard working with the Smithsonian. And you know, there were media outlets that supported Tito's flight. And I'll tell you, it went, you said it was 11th hour. It was 11th hour and 45 minutes. And just to bring back, to jar your memory on it, the night before, Baikonur time, the night before the flight, and you know, the Russians are very traditional, and they follow a very set procedure leading to launch. And the launch had been approved. The Council General Designers had met. The State Commission had met. The rocket was, of course, on the launch pad. Everything was go. You do not, I mean, they are, you know, they're a very traditional conservative organization, and everything was set. And then NASA announced the computers were down on the shuttle that was docked to the station. And they requested that the Russians delay the Soyuz launch until they fixed the computer problem. And the evening before, Semyonov met with Kopyev, and I was in the room, and nobody was translating for me, and my Russian was, you know, I could understand. But I'll tell you what I saw. There was Kopyev basically saying, look, NASA, they requested we delay, the computers are down, we better delay. And there was Semyonov saying, no, I don't believe this man. And Semyonov made it personal. And he said, I believe it's personal. I don't trust this man, meaning Golden.
Yeah.
We have a contract. We're going to honor it. And the tension was extremely high. And finally, Kopyev just shrugged his shoulders. And Semyonov said, that's it. We're going. And the Soyuz took off right on schedule. And about 6 or 8 or 10 hours later, NASA announces they fixed the computer.
Here's a question for you from Bob in Tacoma. And he says, was there any thought given, and or could it realistically have been done to park Mir in a parking orbit rather than to have it burn up?
Yeah, as I mentioned, the original plan was to do exactly that. And the problem is that there was a Progress vehicle ready, and its mission was to bring down the Mir. And there was a Soyuz available, and this is the source of the dispute, supposedly, with NASA. They said that Soyuz was destined for International Space Station. But Soyuzes have a lifetime of 6 months. And the Soyuz had been sitting on the launch pad because ISS was delayed, and everything on ISS was moving to the right. So the Soyuz was at the end, getting near the end of its scheduled lifetime, and it could not have been sent on a long-duration mission, sit there for ISS. So what Semyonov could offer us at Mir Corp was a Progress, and which was basically on the launch pad, and a Soyuz. That one Progress would not be enough, and there was one more Progress that would soon be ready. That one Progress on the launch pad would not be enough to boost the Mir into the higher parking orbit. But if we could have gotten State Department permission to take over the tether, and we were working with a wonderful guy, Joe Carroll.
I know Joe very well.
Yeah, he's a great guy. And he was pretty sure, as was Energia, which had studied the issue. And so I'll say we were pretty sure that we could take the tether, which would, as you know, a tether by going through the atmosphere, the upper reach of the atmosphere, it takes the ions of the upper atmosphere and it's converted into electricity, says the guy who doesn't understand technology. But the tether and the Progress would have successfully boosted the Mir into the parking orbit. And so, as usual, Energia was being very practical. And they were saying to us, you can have the Progress, You can have the Soyuz, and with the tether, we'll boost it. And we gave ourselves, so we launched the Progress that was available in February, if memory serves me, early February of 2000. And we gave ourselves a deadline of April to get the tether over to Russia so it could be on the next Progress. And we couldn't get the export license. And the shame of it and the bitterness of it was that when did the United States approve the export license for the tether? On the same day that the Russian government announced the MIR was coming down.
Okay, let me interrupt you and give you this question, because this is right along these lines, and you can continue with an answer to Marshall in Dallas, who's chatting with me. And he says, wasn't ITAR already in effect at boosting MIR to say that wasn't it actually blocked by the State Department because State Department was already in charge of ITAR? And that's exactly what you're talking about now.
Yes. If I remember meetings, I will say that through most of my time working on Russian-American cooperation, I have always found that the DOD, the Pentagon, is extremely supportive of these efforts. They have no problem with it. They understand when there's sensitive technology involved and when there's not sensitive technology involved. And we had met with DISA, and I forget now what that means. It's just one of these, you know, the defense agencies that coordinate technology exports. And DISA was fine. DISA, in fact, the guy we met with said, this is the tether is 50s technology. The Russians are pretty well advanced as well. And I got no problem with this. And, in fact, he even transmitted that to State Department. But, yes, you know, it was a State Department decision. It was the policy of the United States that the International Space Station would be the space station. It was certainly going to be the intention of Dan Golden that the MIR would come down. They would say to us tonight that they wanted Energia to focus their attention solely on the International Space Station, which is an extraordinarily condescending and short-sighted view, because the only way that Energia could support the International Space Station was through its commercial activities. Had the MIR stayed up another 6 months, we estimated, by we, I mean our entertainment lawyers. We had entertainment lawyers. The deal with NBC and Mark Burnett to do the game show was probably worth over $70 million over the next 2 to 3 years. $70 million that would have gone into the production line. And we had already worked out that Soyuz could go up and or Progress and go to both space stations. And so, yes, I think that the State Department with Dan Golden's NASA blocked it for policy purposes. They would argue they blocked it because of concerns that Russia could not honor its ISS agreement, and they were being short-sighted because Russia needed all the commercial deals they could get to keep that production line going.
Another question for you. This is from Charles Pooley. You may know Charles in Mojave. Couldn't NASA be seen as a socialized vision for space and private companies only welcome as components of that vision? Even SpaceX sees its future business in launching large satellites and in serving the ISS, Charles.
I'm smiling now because one of my oft-repeated statements when I was in a foul mood throughout much of the 90s, and I think I was in a foul mood for much of the 1990s, was that, look, if you wanted to work for the socialists, you go work for NASA. If you wanted to work for the capitalists, you work for the Russians.
And they say that today, too.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's embarrassing. You know, when we did a television commercial shot on the MIR, it would be NASA laughing at us and making sure that no NASA astronaut would be seen at all, even by mistake. A group came to us, and it was for a group out of Atlanta. I forget his name, the Pepsi Cola commercial. And NASA tried to stop it. And the Russians were just totally perplexed. You know, why would you try and stop a commercial?
They did an Israeli milk commercial on this.
It was a milk commercial.
For Tevia milk or something like that.
Right, and later I think that I was part of the group that did the only commercial that's shot on International Space Station.
The Radio Shack one?
Right, the Radio Shack one. And just, again, the obstacles we had to jump through to get that through NASA. And early on, in 1993, 1994, when I was working with Energia, I used to go up to the Hill in Congress and explain to a very confused, busy staffer or congressman or senator that Energia was a private company, or became private in 94, that it had shareholders, and that it was a believer in the American style free market. And our biggest, and then the staffer or the politician would say, what's your biggest obstacle? Mafia? And I'd say, no, NASA. And also interesting for me was that everything that NASA did was by barter. And NASA's most comfortable. And I'll tell a quick story. It's funny because this is, I'm not usually this good with these memories when I'm working on the book. So it's all, you know, what I've been working on the last 4 months. You may remember the IMAX film, Destination Mir.
Yes.
And Lockheed was sponsoring that. And I was present at the meeting when Lockheed raised it to Energia and said, we want to bring up an IMAX camera, and we want to do a film. And Energia said, fine, we'll figure out the cost. IMAX camera is pretty big. Energia was then charging, I think it was about $20,000, $40,000 a kilogram, I forget now. And they said, we'll figure it out. And Lockheed said, no, this is no charge. And the Russians are like, what do you mean no charge? And they go, well, this is for publicity. This will be good. You know, it's going to be a film. So the Russians turned to me after the meeting, and they said, "Who, you know, find out about this IMAX." And I looked into it and found out they were publicly, I don't know the status now, but at the time they were a publicly traded company, Canadian. And I could estimate the total revenue, the total profit that they get per film. And I went back to Energia, went back to the Russians, and had all the supporting documentation, how much money the company would make by doing this film. So the next meeting with NASA and Lockheed, Energia turns to the Americans and says, look, this private company, you know, private meaning non-governmental company,
right,
is going to make X millions of dollars. We want a piece of this. We want, you know, our usual charge for taking this piece of hardware up onto the space station. And it was fought and fought and fought. It's not the way NASA did business. It's not the way NASA thought. And in the end, the Russians had to capitulate. And so, yes, I would say that Mike Griffin, through some programs, I'm not a student as much. I left the industry after Mir Corp. I was burnt out. And I went and wrote a book on called Lincoln's Wrath on Media Censorship during the American Civil War, and people said to me, but that has nothing to do with space. And I was like, hello, that's exactly the point. And it's only this year that I'm returned to the industry. And so some of my comments may be not as fine-tuned as I hope, but it seems to me that Mike Griffin has done some things right, some things wrong. It seems that he's trying to get through the COTS program and some other things, trying to get NASA to behave as a customer. But I think that even after, I think it's been 5 years with Griffin, he hasn't changed that much of NASA. And that NASA remains a government organization that thinks in terms of political symbolism and barter. And hopefully we can continue to move beyond that.
Well, it might be really hard to change that culture. It's, you know, it's pretty big. But here's another question for Marshall, and then we're going to take a break. And then I want to shift from Mir and talk to you about some of the other things. I mean, you have financial and investment and economic knowledge and what's going on in the world with space, with Russia, with China. But let's do this last question and we'll take a break. Marshall, excuse me, Marshall in Dallas said, if Mir had been saved, would it have been integrated into the ISS by now? Was there any physical reason Mir could not be integrated into the ISS?
These are such good questions.
I know. Marshall's pretty good at questions with us.
Well, I'll tell you, Marshall, that it occupied a lot of time before Mir Corp and during Mir Corp. Before Mir Corp, as early as the Phase 1 discussions, what we called in the business the famous Crystal City negotiations in 93, when the Russians and Americans sat down and with the new Clinton administration and tried to figure out, you know, what can we do, go beyond freedom. One of the proposals of the Russians, first they proposed just simply a Mir 2, and that was a no start, you know, that's no good, and it was just, you know, that was just for negotiating purposes. But then they proposed, why don't we take actual parts of the Mir and use that, use the Mir for a year or two, or 3 years, and then build out from that using American and Russian and European hardware. In other words, using the Mir as the actual base of the new station. And the advantages of it would be that it would be immediately available. You would learn how to extend the lifetime of a station. And you could take out, you know, like the Spectrum module, which was in bad shape. You would remove that and put in a new one, and it could be a European module. Or you could take out the core, perhaps, at some point. It was at the 15-year lifetime. And that was turned down by NASA. The only thing that NASA was willing to consider was, you know, starting new with contributions from Americans and Russians, and, you know, we got the ISS. So in the final days after Mir Corp, the Russians offered the Mir to the United Nations, and they were serious about it. It was a formal offer from the Russian Federation to the United Nations, sort of saying, look, we're defeated. We don't have the money to keep this thing going. Why don't we give it to the family of nations, and why don't we have the international community preserve this thing? And they just really felt it was a shame and a waste to destroy a perfectly good, I mean, damaged, nothing that a few $100 million couldn't cure and fix up. And so yes, they tried all sorts of things to get NASA to agree to preserve the Mir, and that was just a no starter for NASA.
Let's take a deep breath and pause right here, and we'll be back in 2 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. This is The Space Show, and I'm your host, David Livingston. Our guest today, Jeffrey Manber. Jeffrey, let's switch from MirCorp in that early history and talk about space today with China, Russia, ESA, Japan, you know, the global markets, the economic markets and their impact on China, on the United States. And I know you were just in China, so let's start with China.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, I mentioned earlier that I left the industry a few years after MirCorp. And about a year, year and a half ago, I began to refocus on the industry and, you know, get the battery going again, and was interested in what was happening. And one of the major changes that had taken place in since MirCorp was the rise in the capability of the Chinese. And I was fascinated by that. And so I went to visit some old friends in Washington and told them I was getting interested in China. And what fascinated me, Dave, and I have to tell you this, was that the people in Washington said to me, no, you don't want to, don't talk to the Chinese. You don't understand what's going on. Don't talk to them. And it was the same argument by many of the same people in Washington that I had heard in 1989 and 1990 when I was helping open up the door to American-Russian cooperation. And now they were repeating it. It's the same reason. You don't want to talk to them. They're communists. They're a threat to us. They don't respect the marketplace. They can disrupt the marketplace. We don't trust them. They can't really help us. We don't need their help. Those are the same arguments I heard in 89 and 90 regarding the Soviets. And as it turned out, I think we can make a very good case that without Russian involvement with NASA, we really would have been hurt, especially after the Columbia tragedy. So hearing the same arguments, I went over to Beijing in the spring. And it was fascinating for me because I found the Chinese space officials to be much like the Russians right at when they were first opening the door to marketing out to the West. And you know, I have to tell you, the Chinese, a couple of things that they told me really affected me. First off, the average age of their engineers is 35. And so, you know, you don't get that until you go into the new space community. You go into SpaceX or Bigelow, you see younger people. But when you look at NASA and Lockheed and Boeing, it's a far older workforce. And second, I was struck by their timeline. And several times they said to me, you think that, you know, when you're overseas, people always say you as if you're the government and you're, you know, you're the country. And the Chinese said to me, you think that we're doing this to compete against you. We're not that rich a nation. We're still a poor nation of a billion people.
Hey, so are we, right?
Yes, we are, and they hold all our money. But despite that, in terms of GDP and, you know, et cetera, they're correct. They're still a poor nation. I don't want to say poor. They're still a developing nation. And they said, we can't afford to do this solely for what you would call political symbolism. They said to me, no, we're doing this because we believe there is value to be had in space exploration, colonization, mining of the moon, asteroid mining. And I have never sat in a government office and heard a government person use words like colonization, asteroid mining, lunar mining. And with a straight face, they were saying to me, this is why we're doing it. Of course, there's some pride, and of course, but they said, one guy said to me, our annual budget on space is equal to the subway line, what we spend on the Beijing subway line. I heard that same argument 10 years ago from the Russians, saying, we spend on space, the Russians told me 10 years ago, what we spend on snow removal in Moscow. And so with that, I came away with a strong feeling. Also, I learned that since, we instituted the ban on American satellites being launched on the Chinese launch vehicles. They've had 66 successful launches, though, of course, there's problems with the latest satellite there's some problem with. But they obviously have the capability for launching. They obviously have the capability for doing ITAR-free satellites. And my feeling is that in the next few years, the Chinese are going to do to the launch vehicle market what they've done to every basic market. They're going to reduce the profit margin. They're going to take over a large part of the industry, and they're going to force us to go upstream where we do best. They're going to force us to be the innovators. They're going to force us to be the ones doing the research with the with smaller satellites and more sophisticated satellites. So on the one hand, they're a very dangerous threat, just speaking here of compared to operations in the near term. And
Walmart.
Yeah. Or open up a correct they remove so the Chinese are hoping that agreement reached where they and the French were opposed to letting the Russians in, and it was finally solved, speaking bluntly, by first tying it to some strategic things that we wanted from the Russians, and secondly by putting Lockheed in charge of the Proton and Boeing in charge of the sea launch. And so I think there will be a way, perhaps following the same business model, to allow the Chinese in a way that that lowers the price of going to space for CommSats, but doesn't drastically undermine the American market.
Before you go on to Russia, let me bring in two questions. They're not really on this topic, but they're different. Well, actually, one is a comment, and I'll do that first, from Charles again in Mojave. And you might want to comment on the comment. NASA is completely political. Remember, the 12 sets of footprints on the moon are incidental to its purpose. NASA was to show up the USSR, not explore space. Little has happened to change that. The only good part of it are its planetary probes. There should be a way to dismember NASA while preserving that kind of things. Yerkes truly, Charles Pooley. I don't know if you want to comment on that or not.
Well, I spent 15 years fighting NASA. I helped set up something called the Office of Space Commerce in the Reagan administration. And in 1987, 1988, there was a pretty ambitious effort made to break up NASA. And the feeling was at the time that we don't have a computer agency. We don't really have an automobile agency. We don't have today an internet agency. Why do we have a space agency? It's clearly a relic of what I was saying earlier, the Kennedy model of space exploration. And if one was starting off today, one would take the research that we're doing in space and give that to the National Science Foundation. You would take the building of the station, giving it to the, the GAO, or what's the government agency that handles leasing and building governmental buildings. You would take the launch vehicles, and as what's happening now, putting them into the Department of Transportation. The commercialization you would give to the Commerce Department. And so there is no, just as there is no central point for internet, I would agree that we need to move beyond the Kennedy Cold War symbolism of a centralized government agency. Is it possible? Can one truly make that radical a change? I'm dubious whether that's possible in our government, but I would agree that there's really at this point no reason for a NASA of the size that it is. Not that anyone would lose their jobs, but the best model is JPL. And JPL is not, I think, really part of NASA. And it does its job well, and it does it the best in the world. And it's a wonderful example of what could be done.
Here's a question for you from Greg by email. What is it like to negotiate deals at such high levels? for those listeners who aspire to do things as big as you have done, what goes into making contacts, establishing credibility, and maybe avoid freezing in your tracks at the enormity of what you're trying to do, whom you're speaking to, etc.? Thanks, Greg.
When I first started working with the Russians, I was working with two men in particular. One named, as I mentioned, Alexander Durechin, the other Viktor Legostayev, and the head of Energia, Yuri Semyonov. And the Russians used in 1990, 1991, 92, 93, and even today, though they're now retiring, the Russians used skilled veterans of previous negotiations who had worked their way up the ladder. And most of the people, such as Legostayev, that led the first Crystal City negotiations, had also worked on Apollo-Soyuz. We, on the American side, don't do that as much. We rotate people in and out. And it's far more intimidating. So first, I'm answering in a broad sense on the cultural differences between the Russian side. And by the way, the Europeans behave like the Russians. It's somebody will start at 28 and sit, not be in the room and provide some talking points, and then at 30, 32, you're in the room, but you're off on the side, and then at 38, 40, or 45, or 50, or something, you get to sit at the main table. So we don't take that approach. We take an approach that, you know, maybe you work an international meeting and you work an international agreement, and then you go off and do something else. So first off, that's a cultural difference between our two societies. But as to how do you approach a complex negotiation, in space, more times than not, you have an overall political structure that's been set by the politician. So, you know, Boris Yeltsin and Bill Clinton made clear that they want to have a space station that would be part Russian, part American. So you have the objective, the goal line has been told to you. And you'll find that a lot of these things are, you start with a template from the previous negotiation. And because there was huge battle early on in Russian-American negotiations over third-party indemnification. There were huge battles over what federal regulations, what FARs would be applicable to the Russians. Those were huge battles. Once they were finally resolved with compromise on both sides, they became the template for the future discussions. So really, there's no answer but to do it step by step. You kind of understand the goal line. You have groups of people who are experts on, let's say, the Soyuz. Let's take a current example. Current negotiations on the unfortunate need by NASA to use the Russians if and when we retire the shuttle. If we retired in 2010, we're going to need to use the Russians to ferry astronauts to and from the space station and Soyuzes. And we're going to need them for 4, 5, 6 years, depending on when the next manned system is ready. Now, in those kind of discussions, you'll use the template of what you can from the previous. You'll have subgroups broken out by the Soyuz people, the contract people, the space station people, and you just approach it line by line. It is tedious. There is nothing romantic about it. You give up your life. If you're the visiting team, you're sitting in a hotel for 2 weeks or 3 weeks at a time. If you're the home team, you know, you're getting up at 7 in the morning and you're trudging home late at night and you're angry because, you know, your whole life is on hold. So there's nothing romantic about it. There's no feeling that you have until you get near the end of the process that you're involved in something, you know, that's historic. It must be like, you know, a great architect or a painter, and you know, you just focused on what you're doing, and then you get near the end, you can sit back and say, you know, wow, I played a small role in something that's still true even today. So it's if you want to get involved in something like that, you start small, and you build up to it.
Well, personally, let's bring it home personal, because I think that's maybe where Greg was also heading. How do you not freeze personally? How do you not get intimidated by being around people with lofty titles and positions and maybe more experience? And how do you start out and make the kind of contacts and networking that allows you to be the guy ultimately to be in these negotiations?
Well, I'll take the second part of it first, and you've asked me to be personal about it. In my case, I wrote about space in the 80s. I got involved in space. I was a writer out of New York, and I was captivated when the first shuttle took off. And NASA at the time was talking about a whole new era of space commercialization, and there would be medical breakthroughs, and we would discover the cure for cancer in space. And I, as I tell people, that was the first and last time I ever believed NASA. But unfortunately, I spent much of the rest of my career having fallen into that quicksand. And so I began writing on space commercialization. And in 83, 84, I was one of the go-to writers. I wrote for the New York Times, for McGraw-Hill, for a lot of the business publications talking about commercialization. And then all of us, both the entrepreneurs and myself, grew increasingly frustrated because it wasn't going anywhere. And I have a feeling that the listeners to the Space Show understand the situation as well as anyone as to why it didn't go anywhere in the 80s. And then I began working, as you mentioned, in the opening with Shearson Lehman and took part in the first space fund. And we lost $10 million, and so nothing has changed in the space business. We lost 100% of our capital. We invested in American Rocket, if you remember that, with Koopman, George Koopman, and a young engineer named Mike Griffin was there, and I think Jim French and some of the other folks, and that was a hybrid rocket venture, and we were captivated by that, and we put several million in that, and we invested in some other commercial ventures in about 85, 86. And all the funds were lost. And then I got a call from a guy named Greg Fox, who was setting up a new office within the Reagan administration. And we were going to be in the Commerce Department. And I wanted to reach out to American industry and promote non-aerospace companies who wanted to do something in space. And that became the Office of Space Commerce, which is still around now with a slightly different title. They're in NOAA now. They're in a different part of commerce. And I went down, and once you're in the government, I met a lot of the key players. I had met a lot of the financial people working on Wall Street, and then I met a lot of the decision makers working in the government. I did that for 1 year. And during that time, we helped bring about the first commercial contract between an American company and the Soviet Union. And that American company was called Payload Systems, a Boston company founded by two good friends of mine, Byron Lichtenberg and Anthony Arrett. Byron Lichtenberg later became the astronaut and involved with Zero-G today. And they had a company, and they had this radical idea in 1988 that they would do work on the brand-new Soviet space station, Mir. And so we in the Commerce Department helped that to come about, and consequently I was introduced to the Soviets as a person who could get things done in Washington. And a few years later, they didn't forget that, and Energy offered me a chance to represent them. And so for me personally, it happened step by step. It was happenstance. I never set out to work with the Russians. I learned passable Russian just by living there finally and watching TV and needing to buy food. And in the beginning, it was a help. In the beginning, in 1990 or 1992, if you had a PhD in Soviet affairs and you spoke fluent Russian, the Russians didn't really trust you. And then if you came in as a business person and had already accomplished something in cooperation and you didn't really speak Russian, you didn't really care about Russia, they respected you more. And so you just learn it step by step. And I had two great teachers. One was in the Reagan administration, a veteran named Hank Mittman, who taught me how to read government contracts. And he was very influential to me in understanding these long contracts. And the other was Alexander Dureshin of Energia, who's still the lead negotiator on the Russian side. And he also taught me to read every single line of every single paragraph. I think that even today, I am probably the only American still involved in the business who had read every single line of the original Russian-American contract. And you would be in a meeting later with someone from Johnson or someone from the international office in Washington for NASA, and they'd say, well, why are we doing this? And you just look at them and say, don't you remember? That's clause 14 of subsection 3 of something, something, where we agreed that. And so I was taught by good masters who devoted their careers to doing nothing but writing and negotiating international contracts.
Amazing.
What you do with that, I have no idea. If someone needs a complex international contract to be looked over, I'm one of the guys who can do it. But other than that, it's not really a career enhancer.
Yeah, I want to get over to talking to you about Russia and some other things. But here's another question that was fired in by Marshall, and he says, since the very early days of space, of the space race, low-cost launch has always been tied to the assembly line and lots of launches. The U.S. has too many launchers competing for very few launchers. Could Europe, China, or Russia break the five shots a year threshold to produce a really production line launch system?
That's the question, Marshall. I mean, that's the question. I mean, the major problem is which comes first. I mean, let's use the example, and maybe Marshall's not thinking this way, but let's use the example of small sats right now. As you mentioned in the start of the show, I'm working on a great new venture with Bob Twigg out of Stanford, who's one of the founders and the fathers of the CubeSat.
Right, and I go to SmallSat every year. I'm very, very up on all this.
And there you have the perfect dilemma. Right now, there is a pent-up demand, and as technology is getting more sophisticated, the demand on the customer side for reliable, low-cost launches for SmallSat is real, it's legitimate, and you can probably base a business plan on it. However, the problem is that, especially, never mind today's financial climate, it's a non-existent market. So you need somebody to build a launch vehicle that fits a market niche. In this case, let's say, launching satellites that weigh no more than 50 or 75 kilograms quickly and reliably into low Earth orbit. And if somebody would focus on that market and develop the capability, I think, based on what I'm learning from Bob Twigg, you know, I think there's a genuine commercial market there today and certainly in the next couple of years. So the problem is on the big end. The problem is that with changes in technology, those birds are staying up longer. Probably we're moving more towards smaller and more sophisticated satellites. I happen to be one who thinks that the commercial satellites of the future, for a variety of technical reasons, strategic reasons, are going to get smaller and smaller. And if you can find the sweet spot in providing the launches for that, I think you got a genuine business.
How do we stand with Russia today? We're partners with them in the ISS, and we've got some political disagreements with what happened in Georgia. And how do you see us with Russia today?
As always with Russia, it's a riddle. It's a puzzle. Look, when you get involved with international partners, you have to carefully weigh what are the advantages for us. And I argued in 1990, and I'll argue today, that working with the Russians is an advantage for the American space program and for the United States. It increases the robustness of our own program. It increases the capabilities of what we have. done correctly, as it has been, it increases the safety of our astronauts, and that should be paramount. And only once you look at those three questions, does it give us greater capability? Does it increase the robustness, which can be the same? Does it increase the safety of our people? Do you look at the political? And if it doesn't make sense from a technical and program viewpoint, I'm 100% opposed to doing it. I resent and despise, and I'm weary of politicians using space for political purposes. But if the cooperation makes sense from the program view, then I'm a great believer in doing it. So just as we get our oil from nations including Russia and Saudi Arabia and Nigeria and Venezuela that we may have political disputes with and differences, so too I think that there's no question we have to maintain and go full speed ahead with working with Russia today in space because it makes sense. Fortunately or unfortunately, it makes sense for us today. Part of the reason we have to work with Russia today, I believe, is that a decade ago, we refused to make the tough decisions when we began to realize that space shuttle was not what we had bargained for. And it should have been clear to everyone, as it really was within the industry, that space shuttle was not the vehicle that we should rest the future of this nation on. And had we made the tough decisions in 1984 or 1986 to move away from shuttle, we would not be in the position today that we're dependent on Russia. So part of my answer is we approach Russia today out of a position, sadly, of weakness. And the weakness is we need them. And what's very difficult, and the person who asked about negotiations, is that the Russians are incredibly good at negotiations, and they understand that we're in a position of weakness. But we do need them in the short term if we're going to maintain our commitment to ISS. And frankly, I think if we're going to maintain a manned space program, I worry very much that if political conditions change and Russia does something stupid politically and we do pull away from cooperation with them, frankly, I worry that we'll ever have the political wherewithal to have a manned program in the next 20 or 30 years.
Does Russia need the United States?
6 months ago, no. Today, yes, ironically, and I'll explain. And secondly, your question used the word need. And need is a funny question for the Russians. They want to work with us. They have always wanted to work with us. They wanted to work with us with Salyut. There were some suggestions early in the Nixon time to do cooperation, and they were all for it. They wanted to work with us on Apollo Soyuz and keep it going. And they respect us. And they are in awe of what we did with Apollo. And they feel in a jingoistic way that Russians and Americans should be working together in space. And they're happy to work with Europeans. They're proud to work with the European Space Agency. But in the final analysis, Russia would be wishing that we'd be sitting down as partners today and thinking about how to go to the moon and go on to Mars. And so they do want to work with us. They want to today. And ironically, with the economic situation, things are changing very rapidly in Russia. And a year ago, my friends in Moscow were very disdainful of our weakened economic situation and very proud of their strength as an oil producer. Today, it's a different situation in Russia, and that contract that's being negotiated and part of it's been agreed to means more to them, the contract for flying astronauts during the gap. If we retire the shuttle in 2010, that contract means more to them today than it did a year ago. So our position has been strengthened. I don't believe we've adjusted our negotiations, but sadly, NASA seems to be on autopilot in that sense. But they do need international agreements more today than a year ago, and they always want to work with us.
Helen in Hartford has this question. and says, I'm always amazed that the people in the space industry treat and think of the space industry as essential for the future of our country. And I've heard comments indicating that that is how the space industry and components of it are viewed, even on this show. To many of us in the United States, we don't see the connection that space is essential to the future of the United States or actually to anything. But it's a nice luxury to have, or possibly it's more than a luxury because it does help in science and in other areas. Can you make the case for why Americans, not just people involved in the space industry, should really come around to the perspective that space is absolutely essential and that we must have it and we must have a manned program for our future?
You said that was from Helen?
Helen in Hartford, Connecticut.
Yeah, Helen is exactly right, and she added at the end about manned, because I was going to, my answer would be that there's a great, great difference between unmanned the space and manned.
Huge. We talk about this all the time.
Okay, and I would say that the dilemma or the question that Helen, that you've raised, is exactly correct. I happen to think that manned space is a luxury. I happen to like luxurious things. And I see nothing wrong with a nation having a few luxuries. We host the Olympics, and we lose money on it. It is a luxury. You can make an economic argument. You can make an argument that it's good for relations. You can make all sorts of arguments. But I would classify manned space as certainly not essential to the well-being of a society in many ways, except for one, and I'll touch on that in a moment. Unmanned space, without question, is essential to the survival and the evolution of our society. I'm sure Helen is aware of how much satellites, from weather satellites to remote sensing to telecommunications, even interplanetary satellites, has changed our way of life for the better. And there's no question about it that utilizing space, exploiting space, is our future. Even I mentioned asteroid mining. I'm working, I know you're going to have on in a week or so, Chris Kimmel from Kentucky Space.
Right.
And he's a great innovative thinker and looking ahead, and we had a workshop down in Kentucky on asteroid mining. And clearly within 30 or 40 years, asteroid mining may be a significant source of our energy needs. That will well be unmanned. Space is fascinating. The use of space is fascinating and is tied to the future. Now, manned space. You know, you either get it or you don't. It's partially spiritual. Exploration is something that you do or you don't. Some people stay home. Some people explore. When you explore, sometimes you get killed, and sometimes you come home with the gold. And it is hard to have a rational discussion on the value of exploration to a people. And all I can say is that previous ages of exploration are tied to advances and a robustness, to use that word again, with the society. When the Chinese launched their great expeditions in the 15th century around the world, and we now see archaeological evidence, they were in Peru, they were in Africa, they may have been in North America. It was also a time of incredible flowering of the arts and science and just the advances within the Chinese society. So too in our age in Europe of enlightenment and the explorers going out. And so there's something about pushing humans out into the unknown and fellow citizens going out and coming back. The problem with space is twofold. Much of the great advances in the past and the great exploration has also been done by the private sector, and to date that has not taken place. And in I think the worst thing that ever happened to the American space program, I can sum up in the phrase, the right stuff. I hate the right stuff. I hate the concept of the right stuff. I see no reason why space explorers should possess the right stuff. Going to space is incredible. It's a joyride. It's marvelous. It changes your perception. I've known people before they launched and afterwards, and they're different. But, oh, in the American space program, you can't really talk about it because you got to have the right stuff. And the Russians have done poetry. The Russians have done artwork, as we've had some, Alan Bean and others, that have done it. I knew one NASA astronaut, and I knew her before her first flight. And, you know, she was ready. She had been trained and everything. I saw her after her flight. I won't name her. And I said, you know, how'd it go, you know? And she said, you know, when it was all systems go, when you're at maxed up, that shuttle shakes like an old school bus. And bolts were coming off. And things, you know, were shaking. Now, you never hear that. And I said to her, were you afraid? And she said, yeah, I was a little afraid. You never hear a NASA astronaut speak that way in public. And yet, and the reason I'm dwelling on it is because I think we could have greater appreciation for exploration if you heard a NASA astronaut say, holy cow, I can't, it's changed my life this way. And so I'm disappointed that, and I think it's been a waste of taxpayer money, the ISS. I don't think it's been beneficial to our society. $100 billion, I cannot justify spending all this time 200 miles above the Earth. But going to the moon, sending people out there to truly explore, getting rid of that bugaboo, the crush of the right stuff, I think is a luxury we can afford as a people.
I've had a lot of retired astronauts on the show, especially when they write a book. But the one that comes to mind that has spoken, like you just said, is Mike Mullane with Riding Rockets, which is absolutely a hilarious but very informative book. And he talked openly about the fear of getting on that rocket and what that was like and what it does to their family and the you know, how they have other astronaut escorts in case the rocket blows up for the families and the wives, and the bags are packed and ready to get them out of there immediately for their home if something goes wrong, and just the outright fear of riding on top of a rocket,
right.
he does that very, very eloquently in that book.
And we need more of that.
But he's the only one I can remember.
Yeah.
That everyone else is pretty macho.
You know, I'll tell you, I read a fascinating book a couple of years ago on the Lewis and Clark expedition. And they brought along on the expedition a few painters. And it would be sort of the equivalent of bloggers today or something like that. But they brought along a few painters who did landscaping that was purposefully exaggerated. And they did it so that when they returned to Thomas Jefferson, they returned to Washington, Congress would see these extraordinary pictures of what the land was out in the far west. Nothing wrong with that. It inspires the next generation. And so I think what we've been really lacking is that a government bureaucracy, no offense to my friends at NASA, but a government bureaucracy, we always used to say it's the difference between the post office and Federal Express. And we need the imagination, creativity of the American society to be unleashed into space. And there's a lot of things I don't like about space tourism, ironically, having worked so hard to help bring it about. But one of the things is you've got to unleash the imagination, creativity of a society and exploration, else it's not going to go anywhere, and that's the problem we face with the $100 billion space station.
Here's a question for you, and it takes us right into part of the question about what the economy is doing to space right now. This is from Rita in Los Angeles. And she says, you're arguing that the manned space program is a luxury or therefore discretionary. What will be the effect of the lack of discretionary income on the space programs around the world because of what's happening in our economy today?
Let me give four examples, I guess. I'll talk about the Europe, Chinese quickly, Russia, and us last, if I may. Europe is an irony. I am perplexed in speaking to my friends in Europe that, ironically, this economic downturn and the credit crunch is going, I think, to help manned and the European space program, because the Europeans have resolved to just throw billions of euros anywhere they can, and they've resolved that supporting their industry, much like the debate we're having here on bailing out the auto industry, at a recent meeting a few weeks ago in Brussels, the ministers threw, I think, 10 billion euros at the space industry. So I think from their viewpoint, this is a time to throw money, and one of the things to throw money at is the space industry. And so I think you'll see the Europeans at the present level continue and maybe even ironically increase the spending. I think it's going to have a very harmful effect on, I think China will, you know, their plans are so, you know, at the beginning that I don't think it will have an appreciable effect. Russia, if the price of oil stays below $75 a barrel, which is about their break-even point, I think you will see Russia again, unfortunately for them, turning to commercial tax emissions, getting currency from other nations, and maybe having to scale back some of the ambitious plans they were just beginning to discuss amongst themselves. And I have good friends in the Russian space industry, and they were just beginning to say, you know what, we can reemerge again. We can do some ambitious programs. Space budget was increasing rapidly. They're building the new spaceport out near, I forget where it is now. It's not Bluesbeth, but out in the eastern part of their country, they're building a new spaceport. It's incredibly expensive. They're working night and day, and they want it done quickly. And they were beginning to talk about scientific and other ambitious new hardware programs. That's going to be severely impacted if oil stays below $75 a barrel. For us, I fear for our future in manned space. I can well imagine the pressure on the Obama administration to outsource manned space to other nations. And if we're questioning spending billions to save the auto industry and we have bailout fatigue, I can only imagine what the new administration will do when they look at what can be cut. And you know what? We can launch these astronauts, we'll say the head of the budget office, and, you know, we can launch these astronauts with the Russians. Hey, we can do some exciting unmanned Mars missions. We can maybe outsource, astronauts to this, this, and this, but we'll resume in 6 years or 8 years. And I have a lot of fear. I am hopeful that this will force through a commercialization of manned space activities. And, you know, do we seriously sit down with the French and look at using an Ariane to and develop an Ariane commercially to launch astronauts? Do we talk to the Japanese? Do we talk to the Russians? No, seriously about doing it where our industries and their industries are open. I mean, one of the things that I don't like about space cooperation is it's been one-sided, where we are sending, you know, the business out to Russia or out to the Europeans. But, you know, if we sat down, I think we should sit down in 6 months and say, let's lower the protectionist walls on international space commerce. And you know what? We, the United States, are willing to spend $2 billion a year commercially launching our astronauts on the best rockets if you allow our companies to bid on Russian government programs and French government programs. And if you make space truly like any other marketplace under the WTO, and you really say it's no longer symbolism and it's no longer protectionism, this economic crisis could be a major turning point, if for the better. If you keep it as a protectionist, government-driven program, I fear for our future in manned space.
Have you any indications of, you know, from the transition team or from the upcoming administration or Congress or Obama, what and how they may look at manned space?
Well, I mean, that's the key question in Washington right now. And, you know, I've known Lori Gover. In fact, we worked together at when I was at MirCorp. She wanted to be the
space tourist mom.
Right, right. And I know she understands very well commercial space and has a high appreciation for the cost efficiencies of the private sector. Reading the tea leaves on Obama, I'll now be one of those pointed head people who eggheads who give all this analysis. But I think reading the tea leaves that Obama has some degree of appreciation for what I was saying earlier about the spirituality or the romanticism of exploration, that he would probably be reluctant to see it go. But Obama said something that really resonated with me. He said, you may remember one part of his standard speech was, "You previous generations argued whether we needed big government or small government. That's the argument for the 60s. We need efficient government." And I think that if Obama can apply that and the transition team can apply that, what we'll see is an efficiently run or more efficiently run space program. And that does mean competition. And that does mean letting the private sector do what it does best and NASA more as a customer. And there was no reason why space, and I've started arguing in the last few months that space needs, as the space is the last marketplace that's protectionist. There was no other project out there where we proudly talk about, oh, a Japanese module, a Russian module, American module, Italian module, a Canadian arm, and they weren't chosen out of a competition. They're chosen that old-fashioned way of backroom politics. And I think that's got to go. And I think if the most radical thing that the next administrator can do is have NASA behave as a commercial customer with a commercial marketplace and one where the Commerce Department negotiates full equal access, where our companies could bid on the Chinese requirement. And that may seem impossible today, but, you know, to get a piece of the $18-19 billion that NASA spends every year, other governments may indeed consider opening their space program, just as we've all opened up, you know, EU and others have opened the defense market. Let's open space. And so I am hopeful that Obama will work on a more efficient space program and has enough of vision that manned space can go forward. I'm fearful, however, that in a time of dire need, if we can't save the auto industry, if we have high unemployment, it's a hard argument to make to spend the billions, to send a few people, a few hundred miles above the earth, and maybe the private sector will step in. Maybe the answer will be for the next 10 years of Bigelow and SpaceX and those folks.
When I was at the Cape a couple of weeks ago for STS-126, I talked to quite a few different NASA people and other people, and they said, look, you know, this is less than 1% of the budget, $16 billion, $17 billion, well, it's a lot of money to us. It isn't a lot of money on the overall scale of things, and nothing's going to happen with NASA, and the budget will stay where it is, and we'll still get the $16 or $17 billion. It's trivial compared to what the U.S. is spending, and we'll just fall between the cracks. I personally don't buy that, and I know it's less than 1% of the budget. It's 0.6% of our budget, and it is, discretionary income. It's discretionary expenses. I don't think it will fall through the cracks, but what is your take on that perspective?
It won't fall through the cracks. Obama may still support manned space in a way that many of the listeners to this program want, but I assure you it won't fall through the crack. You saw the outcry when the auto executives flew on their jets. to the hearings. This is a very sensitive time of how we're spending taxpayers' money. And ironically, we have gone on such a orgy of spending with the $700 billion bailout that I think we have spending fatigue. And I think that the question of why it is necessary to spend billions. I mean, there was a New York Times op-ed piece a few weeks ago talking about, you know, why are we spending $3 billion on the latest weather satellite? And so, again, one of the reasons I'm so interested in working on Littlesat and small launch vehicles, and I think that's going to be one of the areas where we take a leadership role, and it's one of the future directions of the space program, is I think the public is going to be looking very carefully at who's getting taxpayer money and why. So I would agree with you. It's going to be a time where earmarks are transparent, and earmarks have frankly been a major component of space of the space program. And I think earmarks will be transparent, and McCain's going to be very strong on making sure that every earmark is justified. And every, it sounds funny to say it this way, but I think every $1 billion of taxpayer money will have to be justified. And it may come under the military. You may see the militarization of our manned program, saying that it's part of our strategic value. That would be unfortunate, but I agree with you. It's not going to fall through the cracks.
We're pretty far past the time the show is supposed to end, and I know it's late for you on the East Coast. Is there anything I should have asked you that I haven't asked you that we should be talking about tonight?
Well, I'd like to, if I may, and I appreciate the time going through this, and the questions are really great. I'd like to take a moment and talk about the new website, which is sort of just a quick second to say that I'm working with Bob Twiggs on a website devoted to the small sat and small launch vehicle community, which we believe passionately that in the next couple of years the small satellite industry is going to mature, and it's going to come of age, I suppose, not mature, but come of age, and that you're going to see small satellites having commercial applications for everything from reading gas meters to location devices. And we believe that it's important to make this industry more transparent and more economically efficient. And one of the ways to do that is to have a platform where people can talk to one another. So we hope to open SDFSpaceworks.com in January. And there's a prototype, something up there now. And the important thing is it's not a news generator. It's forums and marketplace to buy and sell and pieces of hardware. And we're pretty bullish on this. And so that's one exciting thing, which you'll welcome questions and feedback from your listeners on the site, because we want all the help we can get. And I have a feeling your listeners are pretty sophisticated on this. And I guess the final thing would just be, this may well turn out to be an exciting time in the space industry. That ironically, the fact that every dollar of taxpayer money is going to become important may finally bring about some of the fundamental changes that NASA has needed for many, many years. I think you'll see the closing of the center in the first term of the Obama administration. I think you'll see NASA people questioning how the money is spent. I think you'll see one major program that's over budget closed for the sake of sending the signal and, as well, saving the money. And so I'm pretty excited that, ironically, the tough times may cause us to be more efficient and to communicate better to the public as to why there's a value to the program. And I think that, you know, it's going to be a very exciting probably 2 years in redirecting and doing a course correction on where we go in space.
Do you have any insight as to who might be the next NASA administrator?
No, of course not. I will say that I hope that whomever gets it reflects the Obama value that he gave in his speech of a more efficient government. I hope it reflects the Obama value for change. I think change is needed in the American space program. And if we can get somebody who is chosen by the president and not the vice president and not the transition team, that would be fantastic. If it's somebody the president knows, I will be overjoyed. And that's the best we can ask for. I mean, Mike Griffin, if I recall correctly, never met the president when he was appointed. I think he was the swearing-in was with the vice president. And it would be really, really nice if someone could be chosen that has some ties to the Obama view of government and knows Obama. That's the best we can ask for.
Well, we wait and see.
Yeah.
We wait and see. For listeners who may want to send in a comment or question, can they email you? Do you want them to go through me? Do you give out an address?
What do you think? What's your advice?
I have had guests tell me that they get a lot of spam by giving out an email address.
If it could go through you, then.
And others never complain. So go through me is fine.
Okay,
so here's the ending that I always give to guests is you don't get off the show without pearls of wisdom or really important concluding comments, especially since these shows have a long life to them. People are still listening to programs from 2001 when I started the program. So do you have any pearls of wisdom for us or concluding remarks over and above what you've already said?
I was going to say, David, haven't I done pearls of wisdom for the last 2 hours or whatever it is?
But it's insufficient. You have to keep going for final comments.
I will say that nothing is more important in the space community today than to get the next generation involved, especially after going to China and to an extent Europe. I'm extremely concerned that space is increasingly being viewed much like baseball. It's the undertaking of gray-haired white males.
Let me hold you for 5 more minutes because I've got the next generation kids. I've got a 24-year-old and 26-year-old, and you know they've grown up with me in the space world and all of that. And I know a lot of their friends, and they know the space world, you know, really well, but they're not necessarily involved in it. And part of the reason why they're not involved in it, it's the same old program. It's their old man's program. You know, it's not grabbing them. What is the space program to get the next generation involved in?
Well, 2 quick answers. The first is immediately today, it's the small sat. And I'm working with Kentucky and, you know, NASA selected Kentucky to, with Montana and one other university to launch in June. And the great thing about it is students build the satellites. And I met with some of the students Friday. They were up in Annapolis, and I went and out to dinner with some of the Kentucky students. And they're knowledgeable. They're hip on space, and they love it because they have built a satellite. So my first answer is the old paradigm where a college, a university would start a space project for the shuttle, and it's scheduled to go up in 1993, and then it ends up going up in 2002. Who cares?
Exactly.
The students are long gone. This is an age of instant gratification. So my first answer is that we should devote more attention to small sats and developing the small launch vehicle market in this country so that the student can build a satellite and it's launched in the next academic year. So we've got to do something like that. My second answer is in the first month or two of Mir Corp, I was on CBS morning, I forget which one of the morning shows. And after it was over, the producer turned to me and said, you know, we'd really love to have you back again as quickly as possible. And I said, okay, fine. Why, you know, why? She said, because you can articulate the dream of space that when we get the NASA folks on here, they tell me off air they're not authorized, they're not allowed by Congress to say things like, oh, we want to go back to the moon, until it's policy of the United States. And so we've got to unleash somehow. We've got, I mean, like your suggestion, you know, to have 2 weeks of crazy ideas on your show, we got to have that at NASA, where maybe 2 weeks of the year, they can just say to the American public, you know, we could do space elevators. You know, we could do this, this, and this. Because, you know, the younger generation, that's an off, I hate to say that, but, I, you know, let's just say people today in this country want hip things that are loud, that are in your face, that have drama, are cool, are implemented quickly. If you can't do that, you're yesterday's news. And so you got to talk to them about space elevators. You got to talk to them about asteroid mining. You got to talk to them about building a satellite and painting it blue and putting your iPod up in orbit. If you talk to them about the things that interest them, you'll get them involved. And so, you know, I'll say the wisdom is that in my stage in the career, I can be an implementer, but we've got to get 25, 28 people who are designing iPods, people who are designing cool plasma screens to do that stuff for satellites and tethers and all sorts of cool stuff we can be doing, even if you're not making the big profit margins because they're big hardware projects.
You know, I tell people every year, go to SmallSat. This is where the action is.
Yep.
And it is.
You know, if some people got crazy ideas on SmallSat, check out the new site. But I think that's the future. The future is to take the people who are doing iPods and doing all sorts of things and getting them to look up, especially with the miniaturization of technology. I'm really encouraged on some of the things that we'll be doing in the next few years.
Absolutely. Well, what a great program with you. And when your book is ready, let me know, and we'll have you back on, and we'll talk about what's in your book.
Well, great. Well, thank you. And as usual, I love the questions, and I really appreciate the chance to speak in one soundbite.
Absolutely. And listen, have a great holiday season, New Year, and we will be in touch and back on the air together in 2009.
Okay, take care then.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
And
thanks.
Listeners, that's it for this show. And Irene is on about radiation.
Make a call, press.
Hold on. And the radiation life of the Mars Pathfinder, and that's going to be Friday morning, Miss Irene Schneider from Madrid, Spain. So thank you all for listening and for staying on. I know this went long. Good night from the Space Show.